Richard Joseph Bartolotti. Richard, R-I-C-H-A-R-D, Joseph, J-O-S-E-P-H, Bartolotti, B-A-R-T-O-L-O-T-T-I.
That's a good Italian name, right?
Yes.
Okay. Good. I'm half Sicilian, and that half really is very, very proud of the fact that they're Sicilian. Would you please state and spell your place of birth?
Okay, I was born in Valier, Illinois, in a house. And City Valier is V-A-L-I-E-R, Illinois, I-L-L-I-O-N-I-S.
And, correct you. And if you could just state your birth date.
3/13/47.
Okay, very good. Well, now we can start. We got all that stuff out. You know, I really like to start out just by asking you about yourself. So you were born in, can you say the name again for me?
Valier, V-A-L-I-E-R.
Is that where you grew up?
That's where I grew up, and that's where I live now.
Oh, very good. Now, that's a smaller community, is it not?
Oh, yes. It's, well, the part of it that I live in is probably only about 30 people.
Okay. Well, wow. That could be a family in some places. If you want to mind, talk a little bit about that. What was life growing up in a small town like?
Oh, it was, everybody was close. Friends was like family. You had to make up things to have fun with because we didn't have a whole lot. And I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I'm from St. Louis myself, so not quite the small town, life. Talk a little bit about your family, brothers, sisters.
I got three brothers, one older than me and two younger than me, and three of us been in the service. Two of us was in Vietnam, and the oldest one, he's very intelligent. He's got several doctor's degrees, teaches at the University of North Carolina.
Very good.
I wasn't so smart.
Oh, listen. That's what I tell people, too. I said, there's good genes in the family. So what was it like growing up in a house with all those boys?
Interesting. Well, like I said, I was from a small community. So, I mean, just the more kids you had, I guess the more people you had to play with, you know.
About, if you would, if you can recall, when was the first time you remember just hearing about a conflict in Vietnam?
That was when I was in high school. And that was about when it started. And it was after the Kennedy era, during the Johnson era. And everybody was being drafted and going to war, and that was something I didn't want to do.
I can imagine that.
And I was afraid I was going to have to. I was hoping I wouldn't have to, but I knew I was going to.
So now you were just saying that, you know, you're in high school. You're still a young man. You're still a young man now. Don't get me wrong. But this is the first time you're hearing about the conflict, and the one thought going through your mind is, "Gosh, I just don't want to get drafted."
Now, That's true.
Is that what happened?
True, and I got drafted, and then I started going to recruiters. I was not wanting to go to Vietnam, so I was trying to see what I could get into to keep from going there. And all of them basically told me the same thing, that if we would give you the test and everything, that you'd already be inducted and in, and we can't pull you out of there once you're in it. Said, so we can't do you no good. And then I seen a Marine Corps recruiter, and, well, he told me a little bit different. But then I signed up and go in the Marine Corps. And I did. I signed for the Marine Corps to keep from going to Vietnam. But I went directly to Vietnam.
Now, talk about that a little bit. Why would the Marine Corps perhaps have kept you out?
Well, they had promised. See, I was an instructor and graduated with an associate's degree from VTI, and I was there, and then I thought, well, I could get into welding into something in a service, and that's what he promised me, but I didn't get it. I mean, in so many words. I mean, he never promised me nothing in writing or anything. It was just all verbal.
Where did you go for your basic training?
I went to San Diego.
That's interesting. I wonder, that's where my father went. He was drafted in the Marines, and I can't remember the year, but Greg St. George was his name. Is his name. Well, he has lots of stories about the difficulty of Marine boot camp. Could you share just maybe one story that comes to mind about how tough that really is?
Well, I'd say the main thing that sticks with you is your first day there. I mean, they scare you to no end. I mean, you really start thinking, why in the heck did I ever get into this? You know, what am I in? Because you think they can do anything to you and get away with it. I mean, which they can't, but you think that anyway. And it was just scary to me. And I wasn't a physically fit person back then. I was overweight. I was little. I was only 5'4" when I joined the Marine Corps. And matter of fact, by the time I got out of infantry training, ITR, I was 5'8". And I was 178 pounds, I think it was, 178 pounds. And when I went in, I was over 200 and 5'4". So they put you through some stuff. And most of the people that I was in there with were all well physically fit people, and I had to try to keep up with them. It made it rough, but I was able to do it.
That's good to know. My dad talks about his favorite candy growing up when he was little was chocolate covered cherries. He used to love them. And when he was in San Diego in his training, my grandmother sent him a box.
Oh.
And his drill sergeant found out, made him eat every piece, and then put on the pack and go do his miles. And he said he's never been sicker, and sadly, he hasn't enjoyed a piece of chocolate-covered strawberry since, because it just...
Yeah, all through boot camp, he was not allowed to have any pokey bait or anything. I mean, you wasn't allowed to have anything other than what comes from the mess hall, and only have that within the mess hall. That was it.
It's very, very strict. Okay, so you got through basic training. You came out the other side, a little more physically fit. When did you find out that they were going to send you to Vietnam?
Oh, you knew it all the way through.
Oh, did you?
Oh, yeah. That, from the first day in boot camp, that's what they drove into your head. You was going to Vietnam, and your odds of coming back wasn't that great. And they just told you that all the way through boot camp. And then after you get out of boot camp and ITR, and you go into a staging battalion. That staging battalion, that's what that's for, is to send you to Vietnam. And when I was in it, basically I volunteered for everything that come up in there because I was trying to prolong my time to go to Vietnam. I went through special map reading courses, POW training, all kind of different trainings like that. I had a lot of training before I went over there.
Wade was talking last week, he was very thankful for some of the extra training he got, because he said, you know, every bit of knowledge helped you. I mean, everything you could know was beneficial when you actually got out there, as far as survival techniques and so forth. So how were you deployed to Vietnam?
We flew over there in a civilian airlines. We had our rifles. We had everything. I mean, we were prepared for war the minute we got onto that airlines until we got off in Da Nang.
And that's a long flight, I would imagine.
Oh, yes, several hours. I don't remember just how many hours it was, but you flew from there to Hawaii, from Hawaii to Guam to Okinawa, from Okinawa to Vietnam. But, I mean, you never got off the plane. You stayed on the plane the whole time.
Do you remember stepping off the plane in this foreign country? What was going through your mind?
Scared, not knowing what I was getting into. You know, they put you through all kind of training and tell you what you're going through, you know, but you still don't really know what to look for. And the military don't give you a whole lot of descriptions what to do or what you're supposed to do at that moment. When I got off the plane there, you go to dispersing. Into dispersing, it was underneath the like a pavilion with benches in it, and you sit in these benches, and they called your name out, and they say, well, you're going to so-and-so. And they told me that I'd be in the 1st Marine Division, 7th Regiment. And they said, you get on this truck here and take it so-and-so. And then I got the regiment, and then they told me I was going to 3rd Battalion. And they told me to walk down this roadway until I come to that hill over there and go to the office there, and that was the battalion. I mean, you don't know nothing until you get there. And that's basically how it all ends up.
And that's scary in and of itself, I imagine. I mean, it's a stressful situation in and of itself, and then you add the element of unknown to it, and I can't imagine. So.
But it's, I mean, you're prepared for it. You're well trained for it, but nobody's ever well prepared, I guess, to get shot at or shoot back. It's just, that's just something that you really have to learn once you're there.
What was your, obviously, you know, this is something that in your heart you probably were hoping you weren't going to get involved with, but you were. You know, you were drafted, you went through your training, you went over there. Did you have hopes and goals about what you'd be doing in your time over there?
Your hopes was that you'd make it back. Far as goals, I don't think there's any. I mean, you're just in a survival mode. You're just wanting to survive. I'd say that's basically it.
Sure. Now, obviously, you probably went out on numerous missions. Were you often told what the objective of these missions were, or is it something where you kind of had to figure it out as you went?
When I first got over there, now you're just thrown into a fire team, which the fire team's in a squad. When you're going on patrol, you just knew you was going on patrol. You didn't know where you was going. If you went on operation, you didn't know if you was going on the operation until probably the day of it. Or maybe you may know the day before, but that was basically it. I was in a reactionary force over there, and if somebody got in trouble, they called us in, you know, and stuff. But after you're there a while, and then you fit more into the crowd, and if you fit in with a lot of the higher-ups, I'd say basically do what you were supposed to be doing, and they think you're all right, then you're in on a lot more information than what you would be otherwise. But most of the time, just an ordinary person in a squad, he don't know. He's just following. That's it.
Believe me, I understand. There's a fallacy in this question about what's a typical day. There's no typical day in war. But can you walk us through what it would be like to have to go? Is it called a skirmish or a? Were you?
Yeah, skirmish.
Okay. Could you describe perhaps what?
Or a firefight or whatever. The first one I was in, I don't think it really set in. You know, somebody was shooting at us and we was hiding to keep from getting hit, you know. But then after you're there a while, and you know more about what you're supposed to be doing, and instead of taking orders from somebody, you're giving orders to other ones, then you're more involved in it and you know more about what's taking place and all that. But right at first, you don't really, all you know is somebody shooting at you and you don't want to get hit.
That's an indescribable feeling, and so this is an impossible question to answer, but mentally, what is it like to be in a war zone and know that you have an enemy who's firing at you?
You're scared. I never met nobody over there that wasn't scared. Maybe there is some that don't, but I mean, I was scared the whole time I was there. But that, when that actually happens, that's all, you don't even think about that. You're thinking about the situation, what you got to do to get out of that situation. And so it's all afterwards is when all the other thoughts start coming to you. And you start realizing that you was in a mess. But before that, it's basically, you know, you got to get out of this situation, and you was trying to do this and this and this, and so you're trying to do this for your safety and for the safety of the ones that's under you.
One question I accidentally gleaned over, I wanted to put this kind of early on, but, you know, I think everyone who lived through it, you know, 9/11, you know where you were when you heard the news. I haven't met anyone who was of age who doesn't have a recollection. I think of the baby boomer generation, you know, my parents both talk about that they knew where they were when President Kennedy was assassinated.
Oh, I do too.
could you share that?
Yes, I was part of the team that put the school paper together in high school. And we was in this little room putting this stuff together, and we would listen to a radio, and it come over the radio. And when it come over the radio, I run down to the study hall and announced it in the study hall. And they thought that I didn't know what I was saying, you know, because they didn't believe it either, you know. And then a little while after that, they let school out, and we went home and watched it on TV.
What was that like? I mean, the president was shot. Is that...
Oh, it was... I mean, that was something that you didn't... I mean, like before him, there was Lincoln was shot and all that. But it just seemed different because you didn't think that anything like that would ever happen, you know, and it was weird. It's odd.
Do you think, and this is just a hypothetical, almost thought experiment, but had President Kennedy not been assassinated in 63, and had he won a second term, do you believe we would have taken the same route in Vietnam?
I don't think so. I don't think he would have put us in that situation. I think it was more done on what they thought that they should do on his behalf than what he would have actually did. But that's a guess thing, you know.
Yeah, no one truly knows, but that's, yeah, it's just kind of interesting to think about. Now, while we're on the subject of presidents, let's just move through a few. LBJ, with McNamara, obviously expanded the war. Some people write reluctantly, some people say more reluctantly in the start, less in the end. Do you have any views or opinions about the LBJ foreign policy?
I think he done what he thought was right and what should have been done. You know, a lot of this blame goes strictly on the presidents, but it ain't just the president, it's your Congress too, you know, and their hands are tied to a certain extent of what they could do. And like over there, the war we were fighting, it was, you sit back and think about it, it was ridiculous. I mean, we was waiting until they started something with us before we done anything. And all while we was over there, that's the way it always was. You waited till they did something and then you countered. And I can't ever picture us ever being able to do any good in a war like that. I mean, sure, we weren't beaten. I don't think we were beaten. I mean, a lot of people say we lost that war, but we pulled out of it. But any time we wanted to take a scrimmage against them, we'd come out on top. But that was it. You had to wait till they wanted to do it before you could do it. That's the way the guidelines were set up. And
just to follow up, and obviously you make a very good point that, you know, it's, you know, people like to blame the president or give the president maybe too much credit or not enough, mm-hmm. Just because it's sort of a centralized office that people can point their finger at. But, you know, it takes the entire government, it takes the military leaders. When Richard Nixon came into office, he ran on a platform of having a secret plan to win the war with the help of his security advisor, Kissinger. It was twofold. You can see that during his time, he did pull out troops. However, he also increase the amount of bombings and things like this. Do you think, and again, this is a hypothetical, so there's no wrong answer, but he resigned in 73 or 74? 73, I think. Do you think that if he hadn't gotten into his trouble with Watergate and been pushed out, do you think we would have had a different outcome?
No, I don't think so. By changing presidents or anything like that, I mean, once you're involved in something, the only way out is either to go all out and win it or pull out. I mean, it's just plain and simple. And the only way you're going to go out all out and win it, and the way our country is set up, I don't think you could ever do that, because you're going to have to be pretty violent. War is violent, and you're going to have to be violent towards other people. And we're not going to fight a war like that, I don't think. I don't think that our country would stand for it. And
that's very true. That's very true. Well, getting back to your time during the war, there's definitely a culture shock coming over there between a Western culture and the Vietnamese people. Can you talk a little bit about maybe what surprised you about their culture? That would maybe something that was just so different from ours that
It's so primitive. I mean, everything was primitive. It was something that you couldn't imagine. Something that you read about in history books, that how people lived thousands of years ago. And that's just how they lived there. I mean, it was hard to really see why people would want to live like that, you know. But they did, and they had to.
Yeah, that's something that I've heard quite a bit. It's just it seemed not even a few decades, perhaps a few centuries behind the times with certain things. Back home during the war, obviously there were, and this is very controversial, but your opinions as a veteran are some of the most valid to hear about this subject. So that's why I bring it up, and that's the protesters back home. You had a full range of, you know, you have a peaceful hippie movement, and then you had the other extremes. You had the Black Panthers, you had the Weathermen who were targeting government buildings. You had the gentleman who burned himself alive outside of McNamara's office. What were your feelings about these protests?
I think I felt different about them at that time than what I do now.
Oh, please.
You know,
please go ahead.
I.
At that time, how did you?
Yeah, well, at that time I come home from the war, and the war was still going on, and you was having these protests and stuff, and I thought the people had a legitimate beef, but in my own mind, I didn't think it was right for you to protest against your own government. I just didn't feel that was right, which now I think it is right, and it's a good thing to do. That's what makes your government better, is to have that. But at that time, I didn't, you know, and I just thought you shouldn't. Well, I guess because they drove that in you in boot camp and all of that, and so you wasn't supposed to counter your own government. And that's just the way I felt about it.
My father talks about when he came back meeting protesters almost directly off the plane and being spit on, you know, getting accusations thrown at him that were groundless, unwarranted, and quite vicious, actually. Did you, unfortunately, have any experiences with that?
Oh, yeah. When we landed in San Francisco, they met us at the airport, and, yeah, they spit at us. Threw dyed water at us, you know, be like blood and stuff. But I don't know. I guess I thought of it being more funny than, you know, anything. Yeah, but then after you're here a while, you've seen it at home, you know, where people was against the war and thought you were terrible. We were terrible for going there, and they blamed us and stuff, and it kind of made you hide. You didn't, I know I didn't even want to be involved in a VFW, American Legion, or anything for years. I guess I felt ashamed.
Well, hopefully that feeling has...
Oh, yeah, it's gone. It's not, I mean, I don't feel that way no more.
I was talking to someone else. I was on the weight last week, and he was saying that he had his Vietnam hat on, and someone approached him and just thanked him for his service. And it's, you know, it's a few decades late, but it's nice to hear nonetheless. So hopefully our brave veterans of Vietnam are getting treated with the respect that you without question have earned. Going back a little bit to the draft. Now, obviously, you didn't want to be drafted. What are your feelings about the draft, just in general? Was it a necessary evil, a good thing, a bad thing?
I guess back then it was necessary. I feel that I don't wish the draft was back in. I guess for the simple reason I don't wish nobody to go to war, you know. And then that way you're saying you're wanting this person to go to war or not. And I don't wish that. If it was during peacetime and there was no wars, I think it's a good thing for all young kids to come right out of high school and go into the service. It's a very good discipline thing. But, I mean, you can't have all peace. And so you don't want, I know I don't want my kids to go to war.
Yeah, that's what my father says too. Let's see here. I just want to go through some of their questions before I swap back to mine. Okay. Good. We got through yours. Now we can talk a little bit. Just you. So again, now these are. There's no such thing as. I mean, you're scared 100% of the time. Almost you're up there. I guess maybe when you're not sleeping, and maybe even when you are. My dad talks about, though, he had to find weird sources of humor just to keep himself going. And one thing he still remembers were the socks. He just says, "Oh my gosh, you had to have, when you went out, you had three pairs of clean, dry socks, and that was very important that you kept your feet powdered and your socks dry." And anything like that just stand out as just something that was just like, wow, we had to go through that? Or
I never had a clean pair of socks. So I can't say that. I wore my shoes until they literally fell off my feet. I mean, for us to get supplies, now the Army was different than the Marine Corps. And if we got into an Army base, if we could, we'd steal off of them, because we didn't have the supplies the Army did. And like I said, I got pictures of me at home, and my fatigues just all ripped, torn the rags. I never took a bath over there until I went on my first R&R, which that was, I was in country 8 months before I even, and but you didn't want to. I was out in the bush all the time, and we was on ambushes. If you wasn't on ambushes at night, we done recons, and you'd stay out there with just one or two people, or maybe by yourself. You didn't want to be smelled, and you could smell different than what they did if you cleaned up. And so you just didn't wash up. And I could remember when I come home from Vietnam, we got on a plane, and they handed us these wash rags that had alcohol on them. And we had just took a shower that night. And I thought I was clean. And I wiped my face with that, and a white wash rag turned black. And I hid it under the seat because I didn't want the stewardess to find it. But try to keep my mind off of things. I don't think I did anything to keep my mind off of it. I was always concentrating more on about what I was thinking I was going to have to do the next day or stuff like that. Now, marijuana was introduced to us. And it was, I never knew nothing about marijuana. I never knew nothing about any drugs, period. You know, I get to Vietnam, my first day there in a trench, my squad leader asked me if I wanted a cigarette. And I said, I don't smoke. And he said, everybody in my squad smokes. And he gives me a cigarette and I smoked it. I puffed on it. I didn't smoke it, I puffed. Well, it kind of made me dumbfounded, feeling funny, and I didn't know what the hell it was, and it stunk. And then I found out what it was. It was marijuana, and that's just something that everybody did over there. And I guess that's what we used more than anything to just get a peace of mind. You just got high. After I got home, I didn't smoke, didn't use that, I didn't do nothing, but I mean, I did over there. But I just thought it was a natural thing to do.
My father did too. He talked about that. It was just, you know, it was available and it was there, and something he kind of did too to build the camaraderie a bit. So, some difficult questions, and when I go, and we'll wrap with these. And again, if there's any question that just rather not answer, there's no worries. We'll just skip right over. One of the most
Okay, you asked me what the most shocking thing was to me when I went over there. When I come back from Vietnam, it was just as shocking for what I seen here in the United States, how the country had changed in a little bit over a year. I mean, it was unreal. When I went over there, girls' skirts was right at their knees. When I come back from there, their skirts was way up here. I mean, it was, the culture here was completely different. All the crowds I run around with, everybody smoked marijuana. There were some of them in the crowd that didn't, but they were all, we were all together. It's just a complete different culture. I was more of a backward kid before I went over there, and when I come back here, it seemed like everything was completely turned around. So it was as shocking for me to come home as it was for when I went there to see that culture.
I've never heard that. That's extremely interesting. But I can imagine that, absolutely. The zeitgeist was changing by month almost in this country during that time. My father, and I prophesized this just to kind of share stories. My father is still disabled from the Vietnam War. He was in a battle, and a grenade went off next to him, and a piece of shrapnel cut through his spine. He's had to have, I think, 9 surgeries. He's doing okay, you know, but he lives with that for the rest of his life. Were you injured at all during the war?
Yes, I had a grenade hit me in the back. It was a grenade that was fired from a rifle. And I got an article in there. It's about what had happened. And they'd fired, what I did, I went up to talk to who I thought was the CIDGs, but was actually North Vietnamese that was dressed up into the CIDGs uniforms. They took them off of them. And we were supposed to be meeting these CIDGs. So there was about 20 of them standing at the end of a tree line there. And I had my squad hold up out there, and I told them I was going to go up and make contact with them because they had been shooting at us. And I said, I'm going to go up and make contact with them. I said, but if I holler and tell you to start firing, don't worry about where I am, just start shooting. Because I figured they'd blow me away right off the bat. So I walked up to them, and they told me to throw rifle marine. And I stood there and looked at them a few minutes. And then I thought, they ain't who I think they are. And so I just opened up. Well, when I did, they turned around and ran. So I did too. Well, I was running back to my squad, and one of them had fired one of these grenades from a rifle, and it hit me in the back and knocked me down in the rice paddy. And this grenade was up above me when it went off. And I got shrapnel in my rear end. That was basically all my injury was.
What is the procedure when you are wounded in combat? Do they try to get you quickly and get you out of there?
Oh, yeah. You'll try to get a corpsman to them right away and get them medical treatment. And as soon as you can, get a chopper in there and chopper them out. I was in charge of my squad then, and we was on a flank security force. And so I went to the corpsman and I had him look at it, and he put some bandages over it. But I stayed out there with him the rest of the day until we was all choppered out of there. I didn't want to leave my squad.
I mean, I can't imagine what type of pain you were in from that.
Well, it's pain. You feel it now and then. You don't feel it all the time. It's more, you're getting more of a rush, you know. Your adrenaline's all pumped up and everything, and you know when you're in a skirmish. But what had happened, we was walking security it was a left flank security for this convoy of CIDGs, which the Green Beret train, and there was like 200 or 300 of them. Well, they just wiped that convoy out, and we was left stuck out there in this open rice paddy by ourselves. We didn't realize how many North Vietnamese had actually been in there, was, you know, involved in that until after it was all over with. And
absolutely, my gosh. I mean, that's so powerful for you to say that, though, that your need to be with your brothers, to stand by them, outweighed even your, what would be to me an autonomic response to get medical attention. That's very powerful. Very powerful.
Well, I mean, it's nothing no more than anybody else would have done there. I mean, I didn't do nothing out of the ordinary. I don't know how to explain it. Marines are bound together by a brotherhood of their own, and you look after each other.
Absolutely, especially in that environment. A very difficult question, and again, if it's something where you're just not comfortable with it, we'll just move right along. It's in war, and in war, as you mentioned earlier, it's violence. It's a violent situation, and your prime goal is to, you know, is what my dad said. My goal was to get out of there. Get out of there and be alive and see my family again. And sometimes that meant I had to shoot at the enemy, and that meant that I probably I took a life or two. If you're comfortable just talking at any level about just being in that experience, knowing that it's a you versus them situation, what obviously when you're in the moment, you're thinking of that moment. You're thinking of, what do I need to do, you know? But in hindsight, how does that affect you?
I'd say it affects different people different ways. I mean, you get a lot of these people's got this post-war syndrome. I would say I had as many skirmishes or been in many close calls as it. Probably anybody else did over there. I know for a fact I was in over 100 of them, skirmishes. But did it mentally, I guess, deep back in someplace? Yeah, it probably did. Because when I first come home, my mom complained about me hollering and screaming at night, and I'd wake up and I'd be in just soaking wet sweats. But I never, how can I say it? I never tried any violent things against anybody or doing anything. You know, I still had my sane mind that I knew wrong was wrong and right was right, you know. But Over there, yes, you get, when you get into a skirmish, and after it's all over with, you sit back. What bothers you more than anything is when somebody gets killed in it, or somebody real close to you gets wounded pretty bad in it. You think about that, and you try to think about how that could have been prevented or stuff like that. But, I mean, it's nothing that weighs you down, or I'm going to say it didn't mean. But
I think people, and it's a very difficult subject, but I think people need to hear about losses and about sacrifices and about the things that you and your fellow servicemen did over there. And you touched briefly upon how it affects you when one of your fellows gets injured or, God forbid, killed. Are you able to speak about that at any level, about perhaps
I can talk about it. But that's like, I don't watch war movies. And the reason I don't, I like them, but I don't watch them, because if I watch them, then I have nightmares at night. I don't, and it's odd, because what I have nightmares about, it's about people I was with over there and friends that I have here, and we're all there. You know, it's an odd situation. And so I just don't watch them, so I don't have the nightmares and stuff. And talking, just like we're doing here, I'll probably have nightmares tonight.
I'm sorry, sir.
Over that. But I mean, it's no major or big deal. But when somebody gets killed, it hurts. It hurts all over.
It really does. It really does. 40 years, we'll go ahead and wrap now, because you've been so gracious with your time. But let's wrap on maybe a little bit of a lighter note, higher note, so we're not too sad, because, you know, the good news is you made it home, you know, and that's the best news there is. We're 40 years, give or take, removed from the conflict. Have your opinions about the war changed because of time?
I don't know if it has or hasn't. Before I went there, I didn't think we should be there. After I went there, I felt sorry for the people, but I didn't think we should be there. And now, I don't think that we should have been there. So I really don't think nothing's changed. I mean, my overall look of it is different, you know, because you see a bigger picture, but that'd be the only difference.
Say, I'm an 18-year-old high school graduate, and I'm watching your interview for the first time. And, you know, I know about the Vietnam War, but this documentary has helped me see it at a more personal level, and I think see it far better than any textbook could lay out. Would you have any advice for this next generation? So someone like me who might look into a military career, just maybe a life lesson that you learned from your time.
Well, in the military, you make good money now. Life is tough out here now, as far as getting jobs, getting good paying jobs, making. If you could get yourself the education to be able to do something where you're not going to be a ground pounder or in the infantry, I think military life would be a fantastic life, even if you was in wartime, because then you're not going to be right in the middle of all this stuff. I liked the military. I didn't like all the discipline in it, but I do know that it has to be there. I just didn't care for it.